Should be about 5'5".
Okay, colleagues, members of the audience, welcome to this, what is it, Wednesday, May 22nd, 2013, meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. We have a very exciting, I think, subject of conversation today. It's the role that our colleges of education play in, you know, preparing the teaching workforce and provide avenues for Oregonians to become teachers. And these, you know, this is one of the areas that we've touched on throughout the term, throughout the this session so far. And I look forward to our getting a sense of what's happening on the ground. And we have a variety of speakers who are here to share their experience with us, and I'm sure we have a lot of questions of them. So why don't we get started? I'm going to open this informational hearing on educator preparation and call up our first panel, which will be Karen Marangel, Mark Gerard, and Randy Hitz. Yes, I knew that. Welcome, Karen. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you. Good morning, Representative Dembro and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Marangel. I'm the Interim Vice Chancellor for Academic Standards at the Oregon University System, and I'm here with my colleagues Randy Hitz and Mark Gerard. Before I begin, I would like to offer a congratulations to Representative Johnson on his re-election to the school board last night.
When are you going to learn?
Public service.
We've been asked to talk about four issues, and so I just want to orient you first to how we're going to set up our panel. Dr. Gerard is first going to talk about proficiency-based education and how our teacher education programs prepare teachers to enter proficiency-based learning and teaching environments. And then I'm going to talk with you about how our programs prepare our future teachers to work in online learning environments and some educational technology in general. And then Dr. Hitz is going to talk with you about how our education preparation programs prepare our teachers to meet the needs of special population students, including talented and gifted students. And then we're going to wrap up with some comments on the potential role of colleges of education in the development of higher education policy. So if it's all right with you, I'm going to turn things over to my colleague, Dr. Gerard.
Good morning, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. My name is Mark Gerard. I'm the Interim Dean of the College of Education at Western Oregon University. And thanks so much for having us here this morning. So just a little bit of background here, if you're not familiar with proficiency-based teaching and learning. Let's just talk just for a second about what this is. These are not new ideas necessarily, but they are being pressed out into action in schools and classrooms all over Oregon on a fairly rapid timescale. In 2011, House Bill 2220 was passed and becomes effective on July 1st of this summer. And what that means is that once per year, districts will need to report on student progress toward proficiencies and assure that grades reflect proficiency in teaching and learning settings. And this is a pretty different, this is a sea change, really. So let me describe to you just a little bit about what this means. So how does proficiency-based teaching and learning work? Teachers, educators work together and identify proficiencies or standards, the kinds of things that you might see in Common Core standards, identify levels of student performance that meet those proficiencies, make those standards for performance very clear to students, help them work individually toward meeting those proficiencies, design grading systems that reflect a level of proficiency that's different than sort of seat time or whether or not you complete your homework or whether or not you participate in class. You know, this is about how you perform toward meeting these standards. So this is really a key. This is a pretty serious shift from, I'm sure, the way most of us were educated in a teacher-driven, a teacher-centered, textbook-focused, norm-referenced kind of a system, shifting over toward toward a standards-focused, very much a learner-centered approach to education. So a fairly significant cultural shift in what's happening in schools and classrooms around Oregon. So just a little background around who's driving this in Oregon. Lots of folks are interested. Probably the big driver is the Business Education Compact in Portland. I serve on the board of directors of that group, and they're providing proficiency-based training for teachers and school districts across the state, and been pretty seriously involved in this for quite a while. I can tell you several interesting little stories. What we have right now is sort of fascinating little case studies of what happens when you implement proficiency-based teaching and learning in districts around Oregon, if you're interested in that. But what we sort of lack is a large-scale, comprehensive study of the impact of this pretty significant shift. So that's what we're talking about, and how have educator preparation programs been working to prepare students for this? Educator preparation programs for a long time, going all the way back to the mid-90s, the Katz bill that led to a shift towards standards-based teaching and learning in Oregon. Educator preparation programs got reoriented around standards-based teaching and learning at that time. There's been a gap, though, of course, between the way we prepare teachers and the reality of schools and classrooms. But this ramped-up timeline that goes into effect this summer will begin to really close that gap between educator preparation programs and how the directions that we've been pushing students for a decade and the realities of schools and classrooms that those new teachers will walk into. So on the preparation side of things, of course, we do all of the things. We try to provide authentic experiences for our new teachers. We help them work in teams to identify student performances that meet standards, help them to design learning environments that allow each child to move toward proficiency, and to help them to develop grading practices and systems of assessment in their classrooms that are based on proficiency. So again, this is a pretty deep shift, but all of the professional standards around which educator preparation programs are focused, for us, these are the in-task standards. These standards are very much written in the language of proficiency-based teaching and learning, and all educator preparation programs in Oregon are connected to those things. We also have a common assessment for teachers in the state. Right now, this is called the teacher work sample, and that structure is very much a proficiency-driven structure. So we've been doing this work for quite a while. I think the gap is, and the ramp up, the challenge of this will be how to provide the support and the room within systems in schools and classrooms around Oregon to allow this work to be done well for teachers. I think that's where our challenge rests right now. So,
Mr. Chair,
I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. So,
thank you. Yeah, let's focus on this subject if there are any questions for it. Rep. Puffman.
Thank you. Mark, the proficiency model to me, if I've been understanding the last couple of years of testimony, seems to be moving away from the teaching to the test that we've heard so much about and heard it criticized. So how is the proficiency then measured for the student to judge if they've gotten it? I assume it's still a testing model, but how can you describe that?
Yes. So the way most standards are written is they articulate the knowledge and skills and perhaps even the dispositions that we want our students to be able to demonstrate. But then it's left to the good work of teachers working collaboratively to identify what kinds of performances they could design to help students meet those, to help students demonstrate their skills and knowledge in that regard. So is it a test? It could be, but for the most part, the pressure is around developing authentic tasks for students to participate in that would help demonstrate their ability to do that. Of course, we will always have statewide achievement testing, OAKS, and those kinds of things. And we have lots of case studies that show if you orient around proficiency-based teaching and learning, your OAKS scores will also go up, your disciplinary cases go down, your attendance goes up. So there's some initial pretty compelling information around positive outcomes.
follow up, Mr. Chair. So how are we, and you know, you've said it's new enough that we've got spotted pilot programs going on. You know, there's a concern about students being prepared for college, and a lot of them have to go through remediation. How are you teaching teachers to teach in a proficiency world and make sure that students are still prepared for the task of college, higher ed? Is that still an unknown? Maybe it's an unfair question. I don't know. But seems like something we need to be thinking about.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm deviating from protocol. So, Chair Dembrough,
no, that's fine.
Thank you there. Sorry for that. You're pushing on a difficult question here, and I don't think there's... I don't have the magic bullet here, but, I'd probably have to... I'd be open to help from my colleagues.
You get a lifeline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask, I don't know if it's the same question, but in a somewhat different way. You know, what I'm hearing from you is that there's not really an interest in creating a course in outcome-based education that all teachers should take, but rather infusing that topic throughout the curriculum. Is that would that be fair to say? I mean, in your College of Education? Or do you see merit in a course on that subject?
Chair Dembrough, great, thanks. Great question. I guess what I'm trying to say is that we're doing this already in educator preparation programs. Our coursework in assessment and curriculum development and those kinds of things are all oriented around a standards-based system already. The gap, in my opinion, has been in the K-12 world. But again, this ramped up timeline of this bill that was passed 2 years ago is really going to force that into reality. I'm worried that our schools and districts across Oregon aren't quite prepared to do this well. And we need them to do it well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Randy, you want to weigh in?
Sure.
If you could introduce yourself.
Yes.
First.
Sorry. Okay.
Hold just a sec, Randy.
My question is proficiency-based education really anything new, or is that just a buzzword, the current decade buzzwords? I mean, didn't we always train for proficiency? We may not have had a different definition of proficiency. We may have tested it, but I love the sound of proficiency-based education. It just rings in my ear. What have we been doing up till now? Teaching people not to have proficiencies? I mean, I don't know whether you could sort of comment on that. I hate to be cynical.
No, Chair Dembrough and committee, I can take a stab at this. For the most part, the way we've judged education hasn't been around proficiency. It's been around sort of norm reference testing that doesn't always reflect this. I think good teachers have been doing this way back in one-room schoolhouses days, but those aren't typically the metrics that we point to for success in education.
Well, what were those tests testing if it wasn't knowledge? I mean, knowledge may be a different term than proficiency.
Actually, let me let Rip Gagos
weigh in. Yeah, I find this very interesting. It's my question has to do with really your comment about lack of comprehensive data and sort of we're in a testing experimental sort of mode. But yeah, my experience is that this proficiency-based or behavioral objectives or outcomes, however we want to call it, is really pretty much university-wide, not just teacher education. And you're right, it is a very interesting cultural shift. And I think before we did used to measure, we'd assess knowledge. We didn't assess whether people could actually do anything with the knowledge or not. And I think that's the difference. And I think it is a pretty national sort of wave and culture change. But I'm curious about the comment you made about the business ed compact and what's the relationship between that and sort of this initiative so I'm just curious about, are there some specific principles or concepts that the business ed compact is interested in with this kind of education?
Chair Dembro and members of the committee, yes, the Business Education Compact is very clear on their mission. They are working with members of the business community to assure that Oregon graduates are able to enter the workforce with the skills that our workforce needs. And exactly the point that you were referencing, if all we do is test some knowledge that may or may not buy us anything in the real world, then that doesn't necessarily support our business interests in Oregon. So shifting this around to being able to do something in the real world, that's exactly what the Business Education Compact is trying to do.
Actually, we should probably move on, but Randy, you wanted to say something quickly about...
Yes, Representative Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Randy Hitz. I'm Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Portland State University. Just a comment, that Representative Greenlick is exactly right. We've always measured proficiencies to some extent. Here's the sea change, though. In our current system, time is the constant and learning is the variable, right? So everybody goes to school the same amount of time, but they're all going to learn different things, different levels. And what we're looking at with proficiency education is changing that so that time is the variable and learning is the constant. And that takes that's a huge system change. And as Mark says, to some extent we've done that. We're doing that in teacher education. We have proficiency, we have standards and proficiencies that students have to meet, but there's still a time element. But I think where we could use some assistance from leaders like you is to help us think through how do we change an entire system so that you're really focusing on learning, and where time then becomes the variable. Yeah.
Can I ask a question about that?
Why don't we move on? Can we? I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I'm going to offer a few comments on how our programs prepare our teachers to teach in online learning environments. Earlier this week, you heard from Chancellor Rose about the variety of ways that our institutions of higher education in Oregon are responding to online learning and distance learning, and she provided you with some very specific examples. I want to just highlight a couple of programs that are now addressing the role of K-12 teachers and their ability to teach in online learning environments. I first want to point out that by statute, our programs are required to train teachers to teach with educational technologies. And so that's a variety of, that includes a variety of different technologies, which may or may not include online learning environments, but would include using the internet in teaching. We currently don't have rules around the preparation of teachers to teach in online learning environments, but I'm going to highlight two new programs. So our schools and colleges of education are responding to this demand for training teachers to implement distance education. And in particular, both the University of Oregon and Western Oregon University are implementing two new graduate certificates in online learning and teaching. And I want to just tell you a couple of details about each of these programs. At the University of Oregon, their certificate will serve two different groups of educators. First, those who wish to develop expertise specific to online teaching and virtual school leadership. So these would be certificates to train a teacher who wishes to teach in an online learning environment or be an administrator in a virtual school. Clearly, that we have increasing need for that training and for the preparation of those teachers and administrators. The second part of that certificate at the U of O are for those who are interested in optimizing the best learning practices and best teaching practices in online learning environments. So these are folks who might not be teaching in online schools, but who want to optimize their skills in teaching online learning classes that could be at community colleges and universities, or it could be K-12 teachers who are teaching some of their classes online or interested in getting into that realm. At Western Oregon University, that program is designed to equip teachers with the skills necessary to plan and implement learning experiences using technology, so similar to the second track of the University of Oregon program that I mentioned. And I'm sure that Dr. Gerard can fill in more details if you have specific questions about that. The program at Western is available fully online for students, and the program at the University of Oregon is available partially online. And certainly in all of our teacher education programs, we offer a variety of programs and courses either fully or partially online. And that's an important point because that means that our future teachers are experiencing what it's like to be a student in an online class. So they're gaining important learning about the online learning environment by being students themselves in online classes. And that's a very important part of seeing that modeling done as students before they become teachers. In addition, our institutions provide training for faculty through the schools and colleges of education and through centers for teaching and learning at the universities. So these are programs that would enhance university faculty skills in teaching online classes. This, again, speaks to the best practices. So, for instance, at Oregon State University, their College of Education has professional development for their College of Education faculty to teach online learning classes in the best possible way using what we know about best practices. At our other institutions, we have a variety of programs to help any faculty member university-wide to enhance their skills in teaching online learning classes. We're recognizing the changes in what students need and responding to those changes. I'd just like to add a note about the cost of online courses, and I know that Chancellor Rose talked with you about this, and I'd like to underscore that. Online courses are costly. The cost of upkeep and maintenance is there. It's a real cost, especially as technologies change and courses need to adapt to the technologies. And as we learn more about best practices in online teaching and learning, courses need to be updated and adapted. Also, ADA compliance is a big issue in online classes. We haven't really addressed that head on, and that also requires some resources. So that's an overview of some of the ways that we're addressing our future teaching force for online learning environments. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Karen. Any questions about the online piece? Okay, let's go on to the TAG then. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative Demo and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. Again, I'm Randy Hitz, the Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Portland State University. I've been asked to talk to you briefly about how we prepare teacher candidates to meet the needs of diverse learners, including TAG, special education, and ESOL. And as you would guess, of course, that's a complicated issue. So I've put together a very brief handout for you that lists the standards that we respond to that are relevant to this topic, and then I list some of the things that we're doing at Portland State, emphasizing that what we're doing at Portland State is not terribly unique, probably. We have some unique programs, but the kinds of things we're doing would be, you know, my colleagues throughout this room could talk about the same kinds of things. Let me preface these remarks, though, by saying that even though I think we're proud, and I say we, I think most of the deans would say that they're very proud of what they're doing in their schools of education, we recognize that we can always get better at differentiating instruction and meeting the needs of diverse learners. So we come to you with a great deal of humility on this topic. So, and having said that, we do have some pretty stringent standards. I mentioned the NCATE standards, and TSPC has adopted NCATE standards, and so I've listed the elements that are probably most relevant coming out of Standard 4, which is a standard on diversity. I won't read through those. You can read them yourselves. Then the other is the standards of NTASC. That's those are standards that have also been adopted by NCATE, and the first three standards are the ones that are most relevant to this topic. Again, I don't need to read those for you. You can see those. And then in the rest of this document, I simply list the kinds of things that schools of education do. The first list could be common probably to almost any school of education that is as approved programs through TSPC or as nationally accredited. And then at the end of the document, I list a few things that are unique to Portland State. But again, I think most of my colleagues have programs that they would also say are, you know, that they have that are addressing these issues. So with that, I'll be happy to address any questions you have.
Okay. Colleagues, questions? Rep. Wisnant.
No, thank you, Dean. You mentioned that you're asked to talk about TAG and English as a second language in preparing our teachers. This has been a special interest item for me since I've been in the building for 10 years. I think you may be preparing our teachers, but I'm not sure that the system at the K-12 is really prepared or addressing TAG. Can you comment on that? I'm hoping that you, with your expertise, look at how we're doing in the K-12 arena as TAG, and even looking at diverse ways of providing English as a second language for our teachers to perform in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think certainly in terms of the ESOL, we're offering an endorsement in that area, and now requiring that all of our students have a background in ESOL. We're also requiring that all of our students, and again, I don't think this is atypical at all for other schools, but we're also requiring that all of our teacher ed candidates have some preparation in special education as well. You know, special course, whether it's courses or, as I mentioned in here, requirements in their field experiences or requirements for the work sample. So there are ways that we're requiring our students to address the needs of different kinds of students. TAG in particular, I don't know that we're offering endorsements in that area. It's just part of what we're doing in terms of differentiating instruction for all students.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Please.
In the English as a second language, are you teaching your college or our future teachers about alternatives? You know, like it's a tough job, and you're trying to learn a subject and you're trying to teach them, because a lot of them do both the subject and the English as a second language. Do you talk about in your curriculum, you bring up contract services that are available to do this and other type of one-on-one training, and do you talk about immersion, those topics?
Yes, Representative Dimbo and Representative Wisnant, absolutely. You know a lot about this topic, obviously. So yeah, those are things that we try to accommodate, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, the students that graduate from your program may well find themselves in programs in which ESOL students or TAG students or special needs students are pulled out and put into a separate classroom, or they may be in districts where that's not happening. So they have to be prepared for both situations, right? How to have a diverse classroom or how to teach in a more specialized classroom. And how do you prepare them for both?
Yeah, Chair Dimbo, that's a really good question. We really try to prepare all of our teacher candidates, whether it's elementary, secondary, or special education, to be able to accommodate students, you know, diverse group of students in a regular classroom. We're really promoting inclusion. Having said that, of course, we're also cognizant of the fact that there are pull-out programs, and some our special education programs are preparing teachers in that regard.
And in your education administrator programs, where maybe there's more of a focus on education policy, is there a preference for one route or the other? I mean, does that depend on the individual faculty member might have a different perspective, or
I can speak for Portland State,
yeah,
on that. And we have a very strong bias for inclusion at Portland State.
Okay. Yes, Rep. Gallegos.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you a question. I mean, I think that one of my concerns is, you know, we can train the best teachers in the world, but we put them in a classroom, and increasingly we've not been able to provide support services, particularly around behavior management. So, you know, our teachers might be great, but they get in there and they're faced with behavior management issues. And I see that as really more a responsibility of the state or the school districts or whatever, in terms of being able to provide the funding for those supports. I guess I'm asking how you deal with that. The other part of it is I mean, an example would be my daughter was tagged from kindergarten all the way through, but there was never anything in the Hillsborough district to really offer her anything. So, I mean, how do we... So, again, my question is really... Given our efforts to train teachers, we've still got to deal with the lack of support systems and funding for support systems in our school systems.
Thank you.
Is that a consideration that you make in your teaching, I guess?
Saving the state money.
I represent Denborough and I represent Gallegos. I'm not exactly sure of the question. It's We are trying to prepare all of our teachers, future teachers, to deal with a diverse population. I think we may be getting back to the same issue that we started with proficiency. It's about how do we create a system that accommodates the learning needs of all students. And frankly, we had a lot of work to do on the system. As I said earlier, I think that's where we could use your help. Mm-hmm. How can you create that system when you've got class sizes of 40 or something? You know, that's a problem. And if you don't have the supports for teachers, so I think we're putting a lot of demands on teachers in terms of proficiencies, in terms of differentiated instruction, perhaps without having the supports that they really need to get the job done. I think that's what you're recognizing, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And we can do a lot in preparing future teachers, but if we put them into a system that's not going to provide the support, then they're not going to be as successful as we want them to be.
I'm going to actually flip the question, or flip your comment, let me put it that way, Dina, and that is, I agree that we as a legislature need to step up and provide you with the resources that you need to provide the kind of structure that you feel we need. But I believe that the educator preparation community also needs to step up and be advising us and giving us input into what we should be focusing on, which is partly, which is actually the real reason that we created this session today, was to get some of your input on subjects like this. We are lobbied all the time about, being asked to create particular legislation or dedicate funds in certain areas. Just for example, using the TAG issue, to have pull-out programs for TAG as opposed to inclusion. Or, we're told that class size doesn't matter as much as certain other things. And, I've always believed that as we're in the midst of, education reform in this state, that we really need ongoing advice from people who are doing this work, who are doing research in this area, to provide us with the fruits of your work, of your research in the classroom and, outside the classroom. I don't know if there's an answer to that, but I'd really like us to think about some kind of mechanism for having these ongoing conversations.
Yeah, Representative Denborough, I couldn't agree with you more. I'd love to have a policy, these policy discussions and base them on existing research. We did a study a couple of years ago for the legislature through House Bill 3619 and prepared a 60-page report for you that outlined some of the things that we thought could happen that would best help to improve teaching and learning. And that led to some legislation, including this in this session, 3233, House Bill 3233. And so I think you are responding in a very positive way. That's a good first step if you can take a look at what's in 3233 and the recommendations of the field to how to improve the system, because that's really what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
just quick.
Vice Chair.
That was the one that included the teacher prep.
Yes.
We had several bills on the same
yes,
day.
Yes, it includes the mentor teacher, it includes Minority Teacher Act
okay.
issues, and it includes an element that's new, and that is building and strengthening the partnerships between universities and schools. Because if you, that's kind of the never land, mm-hmm. that it's not funded by anybody or taken care of by anybody. So how do we create those stronger partnerships to create a seamless and more effective system of professional preparation and ongoing professional development? Mm-hmm. That's a system question that we really need to answer, and I think we're beginning to answer it through House Bill 3233.
Yeah.
So thank you for doing that, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I would ask you also to extend that to research that's going on in topics of higher education practice as well. You know, we're dealing with issues related to college completion and the role of the effect of need-based aid or not on college completion, on dual credit as leading to college completion or, you know, improving access to disadvantaged populations. It would be useful there, too, for people who are in this state doing research in these areas, if there could be some kind of pipeline to us in those in higher ed as well.
I would love to work with you on that. Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Rep. Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several members of this committee also serve on the Education Committee. We had an interesting situation last week, and that we're trying to look for a solution. And do you have any curriculum or advice on how you have a teacher for 15 students in a school district? We have a brother school district that's wanting to have a school district back, and the most children they think they can recruit is 15 children, so one-room schools. Do you have a curriculum for classes for that?
Well, you know, if you really think about what we've been talking about, it's differentiating instruction, and
online.
Maybe it's back to the one room school in some respects, in the most positive sense of it.
Thank you.
Mark. Chair Dembrough and Representative Wisnant, if I could just add, one of the things that I enjoy each year is looking through the Oregon Schools Directory, and I'm always amazed to find that there are, in fact, this year, 10 school districts in Oregon with fewer than 10 children K through 12. I mean, Western Oregon University works in partnership with the Oregon Small Schools Association, and these are very real issues for much of Oregon. And so I appreciate you highlighting that, but I think Randy's response is on the mark.
Well, could I follow up then? So Eastern Oregon has been a leader in that. So do you have some special curriculum? Because we're trying to find a solution to that school district. So it's got to be one teacher, one administrator in the whole thing for 10. Because they're only looking at going through 8th grade, I think. Mm-hmm. It used to be in my district. Brother school district used to be now. Now it's Mike McLean's school district.
Well, Chair Dembrough and Representative Wisnant, I believe the solution is in proficiency-based teaching and learning. I mean, you have to meet each child where they are because they're across a range of ages and work with them toward maximizing their own opportunities for development. That's sort of the moral challenge of education. So,
thank you for bringing this up. Thank you.
Speaking of remote rural districts, Vice Chair Huffman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. never mind. I was just going to share just a little bit more, and I don't expect a response here because I know we're running late and I'm getting that glare from the chair. But what we're trying to do, we're going to have some meetings seeing if maybe we could develop a frontier school or frontier district with fewer than 25 kids or something along that. If you can apply for a charter school with 25 or more kids, then it would make sense under 25 kids to have a separate model where it'd be like a one-room school, a lead teacher, hybrid model with online learning. And so I just wanted to throw that out there. That's kind of what we're looking at, because we do have Brothers, Ashwood, and others. You mm-hmm. said you looked, and there were about 10 of them. And so if you have some thoughts around that, Representative Wisnett and I would love to, you know, send us an email and send us your thoughts, because we're going to be meeting with Rob Saxton and others shortly to try to converse on where we might be able to go. And if you have knowledge of places like Alaska or some other places that have remote villages that do this, and you have knowledge of that, that'd be great. Appreciate it.
All right.
Mr. Harker? Did you have something?
Let's move on.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, all three of you, for coming here and sharing. And I look forward to follow up on each of these topics. Thank you. I'm going to call up Deborah Cochran now and her team from the Portland Teachers Program. I think that will follow this panel very nicely. The Portland Teachers Program is one of my favorite programs in the whole wild world. And I think they put into practice much of what we've been talking about today.
Mr. Chair, I just thought I'd correct the Vice Chair. I don't see a glare as much as a glow from you.
Oh, we've shifted from a glare to a glow. Thank you.
But it'll be fleeting.
Okay, Deborah.
Can you hear me?
Good. Put a mic in front of you. Not too close.
Okay.
That's perfect.
How's that?
That's great.
Before I begin, I just want to acknowledge Mr. Wiley Barnett in the audience as someone who helped start this program and was a founder of this program. So we're very pleased that he came here today to support us. And he's actually, we wouldn't be here today if not for the efforts that he worked on to start this program. So I want to start out by saying that.
Thank you. Wiley G., it's an honor to have you.
And thank you for inviting us. I want to introduce Mercedes Miller and Ronnie Perry, and they're going to take up most of this. But I'm going to start out just
and
by
Deborah,
describing
the program. If you could just introduce yourself.
Sorry. And I'm Deborah Cochran. I'm the director of the Portland Teachers Program. So I'm just going to give an overview of the program, and then I'm going to let the students really tell you about the heart and soul of the program. So the Portland Teachers Program is a partnership among Portland Community College, Portland State University, and two school districts, Portland Public Schools and Beaverton School District. And it's also in partnership with communities of color in the Portland metropolitan area. The African American, Native American, Latino, and Asian Pacific Islander communities are definitely partners in this program. And its purpose is to increase the number of teachers of color for those two school districts. It was originally designed as a kind of grow-your-own program, and it came about as a result of pressure from communities of color in the Portland metro area, and particularly the black community. They really actually carried picket signs and you know, really did a lot of community active work to get this program going. It provides tuition waivers from Portland Community College and Portland State University to be able to give students basically scholarships to a small number of students of color each year who want to become teachers and teach in one of those districts. We wrap that tuition waiver with a number of other supports, such as focused advising, required meetings, seminars, and other meetings, a sense of community and accountability, advocacy, referrals, and more that you will hear from my students. There's multiple entry points into the program, but students generally come in as freshmen, and they do 2 years of lower division coursework at PCC. Then they transfer to Portland State, do their junior, senior year, get their bachelor's degree, and then they do a year of graduate school, the graduate teacher education program that Dean Hitz is the dean of. And then they get their license, and they must come back and teach in one of those two school districts. At any given time, there are approximately 50 to 60 60 students in the program. They range from freshmen to grad students and from 18 years old to 50 plus years old. It's a small program. We only take about 15 new students each year, and we lose three or four of those students by the middle of the year. So the work of recruiting and retaining and graduating students of color into the teaching profession is extremely difficult, extremely painstaking. As we try to overcome issues of poverty and racism, systemic oppression, problems with academic skill levels due to systemic oppression in K-12, and a number of other issues and problems. Over the past 23 years, we have produced about 166 teachers. Most of them are still working in Portland and Beaverton. Some have gone to other districts. Some are also now principals or have moved into other administrative positions. Our alumni base is really strong, which we're very proud of. Our best teachers now take on practicum students and student teachers, and they come back in large numbers to speak with our future teachers to support the work that we're doing. So they're very engaged in the program. So I think I'd like to, that's just sort of a quick overview. I think the power will come from hearing my students, and I'd like to ask Ronnie to sort of talk about some of the components of the program.
For the record, my name is Ronald Perry. So some of the components that go on in the Portland Teachers Program is we have a student contract, which gives us a clear vision on what we need to do to stay in the program. And we also have a common vision and goal. We all want to become teachers, and we are all working toward that. There is a lot of program involvement from the students. We are engaged in developing the meetings and planning the meetings that go on for the program. I myself have been involved in probably about 80% of planning the meetings for this year. So we're very involved in what we do. Advocacy. Our director, Deborah Cochran, will advocate for us. As long as we do our part, she would definitely advocate for us and make sure that we get what we need. Special activities. We do service projects. Last year, we went to a school and cleaned the school for about an entire Saturday. And there's also the Good in the Hood Parade, which allows the community to see what the Portland Teachers Program is doing and the things that we're involved in. And it gives the community a chance to be involved with us. And some of the meetings that we have, and this is one of the critical components of the Portland Teachers Programs, the meetings consist of seminars, critical thinking sessions, colloquias, and small community meetings. These meetings better prepare us to become teacher educators, educators in the schools, because these meetings give us a chance to be culturally competent. I'm a math major. I'm studying to become a middle school math teacher, and none of the coursework that I've been required to take has required me to take any classes that surround any other cultures other than math classes. So the seminars and colloquias that we have given me an opportunity to learn about other cultures. And if you look at the data, students of color are often not doing as well in the STEM fields. So having a chance to work with other cultures and communities has allowed me to be able to use that in the classroom. I also work at a high school as a tutor, and so when I work with students of color, I see some of the things that they struggle with, and being a math tutor, I can use that to help them be better prepared in math classes. And again, some of the classes are, again, speaking for myself, I haven't been required to take any other classes that deal with any other race. And one of the things we believe in the program is we teach who we are. And with that, we deal with internalized racism. If I believe that the data says that black and brown students can't learn math, I might perpetuate that, and then again, they still do bad in math, and so I have to deal with that within these seminars, and we talk about that extensively. We talk about systemic oppression, which kind of relates to how students are being left out of, black and brown students are being left out of the STEM fields. And we also have core values, some of those which would include integrity and humbleness. We understand that we have to be, again, we teach who we are, so I have to be who I am when I'm in the classroom and outside of the classroom. We also have a celebration for students who complete the GTEP and SPED program each year. And to me, that's a personal celebration that members of the community get to come and see specific individuals and their accomplishments that they've done. We have a very strong alumni base, as Deborah has said, and they are always giving back to us. And they model for us giving back. So because they give back to us, I'm a senior in the Portland Teachers Program, so I then reach back to the sophomores and freshmen and give back to them and, you know, share books with them, share experience with them, tell them what classes they need to take. So because the alumni model that for us, we then model that for the new students who come in. And the Portland Teachers Program is just, it's a really big community. We acknowledge and respect each other. Every meeting, at the beginning of every meeting, every student stands up, they say their name, so we can put a name with a face, and we know who everybody is in the program. And, you know, we often break into smaller groups, and those smaller groups then sometimes turn into lifelong friendships, and you try to work in the same building with each other. That way you can have collaborative teaching. We're encouraged to take classes with each other and study with each other, because data shows that when you study in a group, you become more successful. And we try to take classes with each other so we can become successful in those classes. And you know, one of the strongest components of PTP is once you graduate, you're never really done, because you're always looking for a way to give back, and you're always looking for a way to contribute to the program and make sure the program stays around.
Thank you very much, Ronnie.
Hi, I'm Mercedes Munoz, and thank you for inviting us to come and speak about program that I hold very dear. I am a graduate student this year at Portland State University, and I will emerge as a special education teacher at the secondary high school level. And I really want to talk about PTP's philosophy of providing excellence through listening, learning, and service. It's ingrained in students from the moment that we dive into PTP's educator channels. The PTP teacher is triple equipped to advocate for all students. Earlier we heard statements about the need for scaffolded and differentiated instruction and ways to teach to all learners in the room. And many of the students that come into the Portland Teachers Program are students that have been marginalized, who have been, because of disproportionality, experienced what it's like to be not included in the classroom, not included in the curriculum. And so I can speak from personal experience and from hearing the stories of my colleagues that our lens is already shaped to look for where are those places in the instruction, in the curriculum, where I can meet the gaps and bring the authentic and whole self into the classroom and really help with that proficiency model of helping all students to reach those real outcomes, because we live in a real world, and we often, because of the effects of racism and systematic oppression, have to know how to counteract those negative impacts upon us. So not only are we able to be sensitive to the students, but also to their families, and to be able to engage parents and provide resources, we bring those into the classroom as well. And so then you're looking at the development of a whole community. Additionally, we are also able to forge and build relationships and alliances with our white colleagues because we've already begun having some of these difficult conversations, already know how to navigate and facilitate dialogue that really is going to impact students in a positive manner and keeping students as the focus of what education is to be about. I first entered PTP as a single mom with three children, and I was in desperate need of the tangible financial tuition support. However, it was the social and emotional support that linked to positively impacting the community from which I had come that really solidified my engagement in the community at large. And I would like to say that contrary to some misconceptions about the Portland Teachers Program, we don't seek to segregate our members from society. Rather, the Portland Teachers Program allows a safe place where students of color are able to develop as more fully human, fully and whole human beings. And when you have Maslow talks about the hierarchy of need and the self-actualization of a human being, we emerge having already navigated the deep waters of racism and oppression that threaten to drown our human race. It threatens to drown the lives of all of our planet. And when we have come through this process, for me, it was a 7-year process. I started with absolutely no credits. I couldn't, with the contract that PTP has, Deborah said, you can do this, but here are the requirements. You have to be ready to take writing 121. You have to be in math 65 before the tuition waiver can even be granted. So initially, the first 3 years were just about being in this place of support as I was gaining the tools that I didn't emerge from high school with. And that is a reality, sadly, for many of the students that are graduating from our high schools. So I think just in closing, that this program is really about offering a way to connect human beings and bring us together that really impacts our children in the classroom so that they're able to emerge with the proper tools that they need to be successful.
Thank you very much. Rep. Gallegos.
Ms. Munoz, it's a great Latino name. I really want to thank you both, the students, for coming. What's the graduation rate or success rate? Do you have any data on that yet? Or
I can tell you that the total number is about 166 students over the 23 years. And of course, we didn't graduate anybody right away because it takes 5 years to graduate anybody. We only take about 15 new students each year. This year, for example, we will have 12 graduates, but there's years when we've had only 5 graduates. So this is what I was talking about when I said it's painstaking.
Right.
To get somebody through 5 years of education when you're dealing with all of the issues, poverty, racism, all of those kinds of things. So it's very tough.
Follow up? Yeah, I just want to comment. Self-Enhancement Incorporated, I love that program, but it's another program that is bedrocked on values, and I really like that your program, you know, has an articulated set of values. And it makes me think about our previous panel and the question that I would want to ask in general. If we're talking about cultural shift and systems change in education, I think we really need to look at what are the underlying values that are prompting those changes and really do some investigation with regard to those values. But thank you.
And we spend a lot of time on our core values. Students are required to write about them, reflect about them. They're expected to practice them. And they're expected to take them into the profession as well. So.
Yeah.
But and I will say, just in terms of numbers, I'm guessing, but I'm pretty sure that we're producing more teachers of color than anybody else in the state in terms of the targeted populations that we're targeting.
Great.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. You know, just for me, one of the great pleasures of my experience of this program has been when I've had freshmen, first-year students who then go into the program, and then I see them 5 years later at the graduation, now with a master's degree in hand, and they're totally different people. You know, at the beginning, they were, you know, kind of insecure and, you know, hadn't quite found their way, and then, you know, by that graduation time, they're people that, you know, I would give any classroom in the city to, you know, just with great security. One of the things that I think is, you know, that the program also does particularly well is it allows students to transfer effectively, right? I mean, a lot of students have challenges with that cultural shift of moving from the community college to the university, and being part of an ongoing cohort, I think, must really help with that. And similarly, the shift into that first year of teaching, or first or second year of teaching, where, you know, as I understand it, they still have their PTP community to kind of fall back on and to debrief with after those tough days. And I wonder if you could say something about that.
You're absolutely correct that the transition from the community college level to the university level, there's even within the first year of teaching, there's a great deal of alienation. When you look at statistically the numbers of students of color that are represented in the higher university, within the faculty, and even when you emerge out into the field, a lot of times all those worlds don't reconcile neatly, and they don't fit into a nice little compartment. And so at the same time that, you know, as Ronnie mentioned, that I'm dealing with the internalized effects of the racism inside of me, and then I'm learning about some of the systematic tools that are actually causing disruption in the community where I come from, and then I'm also required as a member of the program to be actively engaged in working or volunteering in the classroom. So you have almost three doors simultaneously kind of revolving, and it's a bit jarring. And so that support of having an academic advisor that's going to say, here is the coursework that you need to take, rather than me trying to navigate that on my own. When I was trying to navigate that on my own, I was getting misinformation, rules are changing, you know, new policy comes in, and so your licensure requirements are going to be different. That's been a critical aspect, is having that advising, having the mentorship throughout the program, and having deep roots in the community over a, you know, 20-year span. Those are all critical components to a student being able to successfully emerge as an educator in the field.
And I just want to add to that, and Ronnie can testify to this, the higher up the coursework is, the more frequently they will be the only person of color in their
Absolutely.
Class. And for Ronnie, trying to do the higher level math courses, he was almost always the only student of color in his class, which can be very difficult, you know, and very isolating. One of the things that we've been trying in the Portland Teachers Program is a thing called small communities, and both of these students have been facilitators of those. So every student in the program is put into a small community of about 7 or 8. They're required to meet monthly, and this is where they can talk about the personal stuff, and it's required. And they're purposely structured so that there's a layer of students from graduate to freshman so that they're sharing information and pulling each other up. And then also we have amazing assigned advisors. So we know that titles don't mean a lot. What we know is that there are certain people in institutions who quote-unquote get it about working with students of color, and we really try to get them to work with us. So we're very fortunate to have an advisor at PCC and one at PSU who we are just totally dedicated to the, I mean, they have thousands of other students, but they are specifically assigned to deal with our students, and that does help with the transition in terms of the academic pieces. So, and I just wanted to add one other thing about the feedback that we get from our communities is parents who stand up in meetings and talk about how much they appreciate the fact that finally their child is seeing a teacher who looks like they do, and what a difference it's made that somebody calls them with something positive instead of something negative, or that somebody understands their culture, or, you know. So I think that we really need to increase this kind of effort, even though it is very difficult and painstaking to do. We need to increase this effort.
Yes, thank you for that, Deborah. We'll have to end this panel with that. But, you know, I would say, colleagues, you know, I think that there are things that are very unique about the Portland Teachers Program, but I think there are elements of it that can be replicated elsewhere as well, and I think that should be. And that's something for us really all to be thinking about.
Mr. Chairman, I know you were rushed for time, but this is my first introduction to the program. I'm very impressed. Three members of this committee, I think, had two committee meetings in Human Services about people from poverty. And I would consider that a culture diversity background, too. Are you reaching out to people of all colors in poverty?
We are targeting historically underrepresented groups in the teaching profession, which are the African American, Native American, Latino, and Asian American. We feel that they have had very little access to these kinds of programs. We do try to also target those who are in most need financially. So.
I'd follow up. Mm-hmm. But we've had the pleasure of having Dr. Beagle testify, and she grew up in Oregon. And
I'm familiar with
okay,
her.
Okay, so
yes.
It's not just the people of color in poverty, as you know.
But students do need to see black and brown teachers in the classrooms. It's about 90% of the teachers in the state of Oregon are white, and our demographics in the classroom are shooting.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think there's a paradigm shift for all students and for the colleagues. So it's not just for the students of color, but if I live in a southeast rural community and I've never encountered a person of color, or I come into this building with stereotypes, there's an exchange, and there's a dialogue, and there's learning, and there's healing for all.
Okay, thank you very much. Ronnie, Mercedes, Deborah, it's been an honor to have you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Okay, our next panel is Linda Samick, John Watsky, Scott Fletcher.
Mr. Chair?
From Oregon's independent universities. Yes.
While this panel is coming up, just let me chime in that I'm very happy that Beaverton School District is participating in that program. I was in Winco Foods the other night, and the variety of skin colors and languages being spoken in that store has changed radically over the 20-some years that I've been shopping out there. So,
mm-hmm. Thank you.
And advertisement.
Okay, welcome.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you for accepting our invitation today.
Thank you, and good morning. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Scott Fletcher. I'm Dean of the College, the Graduate School of Education and Counseling, Lewis and Clark College, and I'm also here as the president of the Oregon Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, which is the professional umbrella group for both private and public teacher preparation institutions. I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves.
Good morning, Chair Denbrough and committee. My name is Linda Samick. For the last 5 years, I've been the Dean of the School of Education at George Fox University. I've just transitioned into the provost role there. I also serve as the chair of the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities, Deans and Directors of Teacher Education. And just one comment I'd like to make is to remind you that as independent institutions, we do prepare slightly more than half of the new teachers in the state of Oregon, so we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm John Watsky. I'm the Dean of the School of Education at the University of Portland. This is year four for me here in the great state of Oregon, and recognize one of our esteemed emeriti faculty, Professor Gallegos.
So, Chair Denbrough and committee, I'd like to applaud the work of our public institution colleagues and the way that they address some of the specific issues that you gave us, and we won't repeat that, or even for the moment try to extend it. What we'd like to do is to build some foundation kind of under some of those descriptions of specific programs, and here's the reason why. And Chair Denbrough, goes back to something that I think you said in that discussion, which is to say it's easy to move from a specific idea or a specific need to building a cog into a teacher preparation program. So if proficiency-based education is, for the moment, something that concerns us, why doesn't teacher education create that course required of all students to get the job done that way? Well, I know none of us think that institutions like universities and colleges or even professional preparation programs operate in such a way, that is to say, that any individual action or requirement can transform either the institution itself or its graduates in terms of the practice that they engage in complex institutions like the schools that they serve. So what we want to do is step back a little bit today and try to give you some structural supports for the kind of improvements that we're talking about today. And in some ways, again, Chair Dimber, this is an answer to your question about how we might work more closely together. So one of the most important pillars of the foundation that we can build as teacher preparation programs that will help promote all of the kinds of innovative and progressive practices that we are talking about here today is through what is probably the biggest discussion in this professional field right now, and that's the clinical experience. And by clinical experience, I mean the portion of a pre-service teacher's preparation program that integrates their higher education work with their work in a school. So we say clinical preparation here, or the clinical experience, to get away from the idea that this is simply an internship. And if I might go back to a model that has sort of not been real for decades, but which lingers in the public imagination, of the field experience for teachers in training being a kind of sink or swim immersion in teaching, where they go out to a school, they get a little support from a mentor teacher or cooperating teacher, and then that teacher heads for the workroom. And the intern either prospers and is successful or leaves the profession immediately for another. As I said, that model has not been real for decades or for a long time. It, in fact, is virtually the opposite of that in the best teacher education programs. And so what do I mean by the opposite of that? I mean that that mentor or cooperating teacher actually serves as a colleague for the early career teacher. We might call them early career teachers as opposed to pre-service teachers, who are in the classroom working together. A more recent kind of model or term for this kind of model is co-teaching. And one of the reasons why I think this is particularly relevant is, first, that it foregrounds the professional relationship of teachers in the classroom to teachers early in their career that are also studying in higher education. It foregrounds the necessity of collaboration between schools, public schools, and higher education, rather than accentuating or even increasing the chasm between them. So we're long past the ivory tower versus the gritty reality of public schools. Where we are now is teacher preparation programs in schools, faculty in schools, pre-service teachers in schools teaching with their experienced mentors. And at the sort of most explicit public level, one of the ways to say, to describe the good in this is who under the current circumstances that we face in schools does not want two adults in the classroom, two or more adults in the classroom. So when we have classrooms of diverse students with diverse needs, and by the way, I couldn't agree more with our earlier colleague's description of differentiation being attention to each student, not groups of students, but to each student, and we don't need to necessarily identify these groups. Sometimes it's not even helpful to say that they're groups, but to say that all instruction is individual, because all learning, all growth, all nourishing experiences in public schools are individual. So we place our pre-service teachers into situations where they work with their experienced colleagues to produce the kinds of results that we expect and that we support across the board as educational policy that benefits all children. So the way that higher education works in schools to help teachers move from the earliest part of their preparation as effective teachers through the most sort of complex master level of teaching is a continuum rather than a bridge between different institutions. And that's where my colleague, Dr. Watzke, will take up that argument.
Great. Just three very, very brief comments. One is, and these are around professional development, and that is that we really look at the career span in terms of education and educators and leaders as well. So our work is really not simply the pre-service teacher, those teachers who are about to enter the field, but it's really also the in-service teachers, those who have taught for 5, 10, 15, 20 years and are seeking continuing education. So notions around proficiency-based education, you know, we believe should be framed around this notion of professional development and career span education. So it's not only about preparing those to teach in those in that capacity, but about also working with those who are teaching to better teach in that capacity as well. But there's a leadership side to that as well. Our leadership ranks come from teaching as well, and those are typically through professional development pathways as well, those who have been out of the field at least 5 years or entering principalship programs and looking at superintendency after decades as well. And that's a role that we play with K-12 systems, how to provide that continuing career span education. Around that, some of the skills that are embedded in there in those programs really center on the formative side of assessment, that is, how do teachers know and how do school leaders know in the here and now where our students are? How do we provide remedial pathways, reteaching, or new pathways to extend learning? But also in the summative side, how do we know who is gaining and who is not gaining? Where are learning gains happening, where they're not? And how do you do that technically as a teacher in a classroom, student to student? How do you look at that as a school and as a school system? And that's very much integrated into our programs, but we often teach those programs with teacher leaders as adjunct faculty or within clinical settings where this is happening. So that's sort of the span we look at, but those real assessment skills are key there, and it's something to keep in mind to look for, but also to teach to as well. Finally, I just want to say that this system happens in a variety of ways and in conjunction with many different nonprofits. Representative Gallegos mentioned his daughter in Hillsboro. We're at the University of Portland are affiliated with Saturday Academy, which reaches about 6,000 students a year around STEM education. They're based on the campus. They have a deeper reach now in North Portland in just the last few years, reaching students of color and poverty as well. They employ many professionals out in the fields in business, but also higher ed to teach those courses. Just contracted with Hillsboro to offer courses and programming that are push-in during the school day and also after school. They collaborate with Sun Programming in the Portland area for after-school programs. So those are the kind of different ways that this happens. PSU offers a variety of STEM courses and STEM education courses for teachers and leaders as well during the summer months when they're free of time, and those are taught again by professionals in higher ed and specialists out in the field and the sciences as well. So that's sort of the last point I want to leave you with, is that larger framework, that career span education piece, which was so vital to any kind of change or reform in the schools or turning the system upside down, really has to happen with the nonprofits as well. It's not solely higher education. It's not solely K-12.
Chair Dembro and committee members, a piece that we noted you were specifically interested in, as you talked with our colleagues earlier, had to do with differentiation of instruction for children from with areas like TAG, special needs, and we also heard you talk about English language learners. So I wanted to touch on some of those pieces just briefly. Most of our institutions are part of an initiative that was, I think, started with Bill Rhodes, who was in the Hillsboro School District at the time, is now the superintendent in Westland Wilson, looking at the need for preparation for all teachers to work with children who come from homes where English is not the language that they hear spoken most often. And our new teachers coming in need to have the ability to help them develop academic language, to be able to think about the skills, the knowledge, the performances that will be required of them in colleges and universities in the workforce when they leave K-12. So we've been excited about that statewide movement to think very carefully about how we serve each child. The National Association of Education for Young Children in the last few years actually rewrote their standards to talk about serving each child as opposed to serving all children. Individual children can get lost in all children, and what's really important and what we try to instill in our candidates is the careful look at each child in their classroom. That can be overwhelming. I think back to my years of teaching middle school math. It was fun to listen to this young man earlier. In Woodburn, I had 175 seventh and eighth graders every day, and thinking about how you differentiate instruction for 175 individuals is a daunting task. So we do what we can with that. Some of the things that we've been doing at George Fox University, our undergraduate teacher education program runs an after-school program at Edwards Elementary, which is our most diverse elementary school in the Newburgh system. They call it RAMP, Reading Adventures and Math Possibilities. They work with second grade kids one day a week and fifth grade kids another day of the week and spend an hour with them after school on those skills that they need to move on and be successful in school. I would also say that in our program, several years ago, as we were looking at beginning a special education program, we realized that all of our candidates, whether they're going to be in pull-out special ed programs or where they might be working, have a need to know how to work with each of those students in their classrooms. We've redesigned the entire core of both our Master of Arts in Teaching program and our undergraduate teacher education program so that all of our students have good preparation to be able to work with a diversity of needs in the classroom. And I've seen that from my colleagues' institutions across the state as we've been very careful to think about the population that our candidates will be addressing as they move into the field. And I think as I look at our challenges, one of the challenges is that both K-12 and higher ed are stretched for resources. We often don't think about the need for collaboration across those two sectors. And anything that you folks can do to encourage or support or provide opportunities for us to work together will be increasingly important in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Samick. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask you a global question about all the institutions, both private and otherwise. And maybe it was asked of an earlier when I had to step out, and I apologize if it was. But there's an individual that works in the building a lot that is very involved and concerned about Mandarin language learning. Are there teaching programs in the state that address Mandarin language teaching, and if so, do you have any idea how many teachers per year we're turning out?
Representative Huffman and committee, funny you should ask. George Fox University in particular, I'll start there. We have quite a number of Chinese national students on our campus, and the majority of them prefer to major in business. That's why they come to the U.S., but we've been increasingly successful with recruiting some of those students to think about teaching in schools, and we do have several who have recently completed our Master of Arts in Teaching program and are have earned endorsements in Mandarin, in the Chinese language, and are teaching in dual immersion programs in the Portland area. The number is very small. I think that the interest is certainly growing, and I know that there are several other institutions in the state that have approved endorsement programs in Chinese, so I'm hoping that we will see some growth there. I cannot give you specific numbers. Our colleagues from Teacher Standards and Practices Commission might be able to do that, talk about the licensed teachers right now.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for raising that subject, Vice Chair. Rep. Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean Samick?
Samick, yes.
You mentioned, and I really endorse you saying we need to change to teaching each child versus all children. And I should have asked this to the state teacher programs. In Redmond, under the leadership of Superintendent Vicki Fleming, we started a proficiency academy, the Redmond Proficiency Academy. Could you comment on that, and your teachers are looking at that? Or?
Certainly. George Fox has a program that operates in Redmond, actually. We are housed in the new high school in the Redmond School District at Ridgeview. So we've been highly engaged with the district in that work. And it's interesting to think about proficiency-based education. I think as my colleague Dr. Girard mentioned earlier, we've always been proficiency-based in teacher preparation because we have a whole range of outcomes that we expect, and we don't recommend for licensure anyone who has not met the expected proficiencies for a teacher. In the school district, I think one of the most difficult things for teachers has been how to think about what we know as the report card, the grading piece of it. We have standards. We know what the knowledge, skills, and dispositions are that kids should have for the workforce and moving forward. What seems to be more difficult is how you document those things, so building portfolios of evidence to show that proficiency has been met, and then reporting to parents and the public rather than A, B, C, D, F grades, met, not met, needs improvement. So those are some of the pieces that we work with our students, as well as how to think about messaging that to the community, which is difficult.
Thanks for those comments.
Yeah. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Provost, I'd like to bore in a bit on the role of TSPC and how they relate to you all. You're training over half of our incoming teachers and so forth. But
certainly.
Dean Hitz's report or his comments here, he says teacher preparation programs are highly regulated by Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And we heard earlier in Mark's testimony about proficiency-based and so forth, and how they're reacting to the bill that was passed in the 2011 session. So my question is, do you all have to wait for TSPC to bring you the new standards that you now prepare your teachers to, or are you able to try to get ahead of that? Tell me about that relationship and how that works, and is in fact the system reacting to the things that occur here?
Yes,
and as they
certainly
get transitioned out to the field.
Certainly. Representative Johnson and Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, in full disclosure, I have to tell you that I was the Deputy Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission from 2000 to 2002. So just so you are aware of that. Let me give you an example of how we work collaboratively with Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Yesterday at George Fox University from 9 a.m. until 3 p.m., we had 60 faculty and administrators gathered from most of the institutions in the state, including everyone from Southern Oregon to Eastern Oregon and most of the Portland area universities, where we were taking a look at standards. And I would say that we are full participants. The commission itself, which, as you are very aware, is not just the staff, but 17 commissioners who represent K-12 teachers, administrators, higher ed, and the public. And our commissioner right at the moment is Mark Ankeny, who is from Pacific University. And we, there's always an interesting relationship between state agencies and private enterprise. And I will tell you that there are times when we probably grit our teeth and say, okay, if you say we have to, we will. But I do believe that we often have opportunity to have input into things that happen with Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And then there are other places where Scott and I could probably talk to you about when we chair the two organizations that we do, where we butt heads with Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and they don't always listen to us. So,
okay. You and I could follow up offline about that. I'd be happy to. Another follow-up I would have is regarding another piece of legislation that passed back in 2011 and 12, and that would be Senate Bill 290, which is about educator evaluations and so forth, and how that really will transform how we evaluate effective classroom instruction, but also how we evaluate that effectively as well. It's not just the teachers that it applies to, it's the administrators, i.e. the principals and
sure.
so forth. How has that legislation informed what's happening with you all as you prepare the next generation of teachers to be able to effectively engage in that sort of a classroom in Oregon?
Representative Johnson, my two colleagues here, along with George Fox and the two institutions represented earlier, are all nationally accredited as well as being approved by the state of Oregon. So I think I can justifiably say to you that we have been out front of a lot of the things that were addressed in Senate Bill 290 because of the national standards that we pay very close attention to. And a number of us serve on national committees and do work across the country as well. So many of those are ideas we've been working with for a number of years. They were not new to us.
And one more quick follow-up. Currently, teacher probationary status for a new teacher is typically 3 years before they achieve contract status. Would you see any wisdom in expanding that to 5 years to ensure that we're making sure that this is a good career path for that individual and that, in fact, they are destined for success?
Well, at my university, you're on probationary status for 6 years, so I guess I probably shouldn't speak against that. I think I'll defer to my colleagues about that.
Whether it's three or five, the important piece is what is the plan during those 5 years. If it's simply a waiting time or to add a degree, if you enter teaching with a BA, I would wonder whether that 2 years is going to make a difference. If there's a specific plan around that, requirements, proficiencies, whatever, you know, then I think we're really talking, you know, turkey, to use an Iowa phrase.
John, that was a very politic response. I think, and actually a correct one, I believe. But we've run out of time. Vicki, can you come back? Would that be all right? I'm really sorry. I was looking forward to hearing from you and having you sort of respond to all of this. But we'll find another time for you to do that. We all have to go to these other meetings right now. Scott, one final comment?
Well, yes. Since invited, I know you're in a hurry. I want to go back to the brief comments that framed this and answer to your question, what now and how can you help? What you can do to help is build that connection between higher education and public schools. And some of the very concrete ways that that can be done is to recognize and compensate public school teachers who are participating in the preparation of pre-service teachers. They need time. They need time to work with our students. They need time to plan with each other. They need time to come to become part of the culture of teacher preparation. Higher ed has absolutely got its hand out in this regard, not this way, but this way, as a partner in that work.
That's an excellent point. Thank you. Okay, thank all three of you
thank
for
you.
Coming, and everyone for engaging in what I think was a fascinating set of conversations. And with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing. We are adjourned until a week from today.